other mystery to his great power. Mr. Ford has in his organization thousands of men better educated than he, with more personality than he, and with as much intelligence as he. The major difference between him and them is solely a difference in ego. He has a self-made ego free of limitation and dissipation. The others have egos which have grown out of their drifting attitude, their lack of definiteness of purpose, and their limitation of ambition. There is no other difference, and it is a difference which distinguishes success from failure in every walk of life. The Ford ego has now become so definitely permanent that I doubt if Ford himself could change it. That ego is so positive that it does not recognize such things as immovable obstacles. This habitual attitude has conditioned Mr. Ford's mind perfectly for the continuous operation of faith. It knows nothing about retreating. It moves only in one direction, and that is forward. The human ego, the personality of the individual, may be likened to a magnet which attracts everything that harmonizes with its nature. Ford magnetizes his ego with desires and plans that have practically no limitations. He thereby commandeers into his service faith, the most powerful law of nature, with which the physical counterpart of his desires is acquired. Henry Ford's ego is literally absorbed by a single obsession to the realization of which he subordinates all other desires. Any man who can focus his desires upon a single definite purpose and then fan that desire into a white flame of obsession can have the object of that desire as easily as Ford built his vast industrial empire, which, as everyone knows, is and has for many years been his obsession. The great leaders are known to have attained their greatness as the result of some outside influence which enabled them to remove limitations from their ego and replace them with faith. Without doubt, Napoleon Bonaparte's astounding ego was controlled by the influence of his first wife. When he voluntarily removed himself from that influence, his permanent failure was not far away. Charles Dickens wrote his greatest book, David Copperfield, as a result of the change in his ego brought about by the influence of his first sweetheart, and incidentally, he wrote that book around his own experiences. Lincoln would doubtlessly have remained an obscure lawyer if his love for Anne Rutledge had not awakened his ego and magnetized it with her ambition. The second Mrs. Thomas A. Edison was the urge back of the famous Edison ego which gave America a great inventive genius. From the first time he ever saw her until his death, she was the moving spirit of his life. The changes she made in his ego were lasting and profound. I have Edison's word for this. These are some of the men of outstanding achievement whose egos were modified by the women of their choice. I have observed hundreds of men of lesser achievements whose success was due to the influence of their wives. Every man comes finally to resemble those who make the strongest impression upon his mind. We are all creatures of imitation, and naturally we try to imitate the heroes of our choice. Fortunate indeed is the person whose hero is a person of great faith, because hero worship carries with it something of the nature of the one who is worshipped. In conclusion, let me summarize what has been said on the subject of ego by calling attention to the fact that it represents the fertile garden spot wherein one may develop all the stimuli that inspire active faith, or by neglecting to do so, one may allow this fertile soil to produce a negative crop of fear and doubt and indecision, leading to failure. Applied faith, so critical to taking action necessary for success, is inspired, commanded, and propelled by the ego. Faith unmistakably identifies itself through the look in one's eyes, the expression on the face, and the tone of the voice. Fear identifies itself through the same sources. Faith is a state of mind that can be induced by desiring, believing, and doing. Is it not significant that all great leaders are known to possess great faith? People do not lack strength. They lack will. Victor Hugo. Chapter 2. Enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, the emotions put into action through spiritual power, is the beginning of all great achievements of whatever nature. Everyone desires to achieve personal success in one form or another. But only those who acquire the habit of fanning the fire of enthusiasm into a white heat of obsessional desire ever attain noteworthy success. More than 40 years ago, the stepmother of a young mountaineer called him into the family living room, excluded the other children of the family from the conference, and said something which changed his entire life for the better, and at the same time planted in his mind a desire which he has transplanted into thousands of other minds, the desire to become self-determining through the rendering of useful service. This boy was only 11 years of age, but he was known among the mountain folk as the worst boy in the county. This is what his stepmother said to him. "People misjudge you. They call you the worst boy in the county, but you are not the worst boy. You are the most active boy, and all you need is a definite purpose to which you can direct the attention of your inquiring mind. You have a keen imagination and plenty of initiative. Therefore, I suggest that you become a writer. If you will do this, and give as much interest to reading and writing as you have been devoting to playing pranks on the neighbors, you may live to see the time when your influence will be felt throughout this state." There was something in the stepmother's tone of voice which registered effectively in the bad boy's mind. He caught the spirit of enthusiasm in which his stepmother had spoken to him, and began immediately to act on her suggestion. By the time he was 15 years of age, he was writing newspaper and magazine stories that were being published in small newspapers and magazines. His writing was not brilliant, but it carried a spirit of enthusiasm which made it readable. At the age of 25, he was assigned by the editor of Bob Taylor's magazine to write the story of Andrew Carnegie's achievements in industry. That assignment was destined to bring another change in his life, for it led not only to an opportunity to write books that would make his influence felt throughout the state, as his stepmother had suggested, but that influence now extends throughout a major portion of the world, and it is obviously destined to render useful service in helping to save the American way of life from annihilation. In the interview with Andrew Carnegie, this young writer was moved by Mr. Carnegie's enthusiasm. He acquired the spirit of that enthusiasm, and it has been that spirit which has made his books bestsellers for many years. I am proud to state that I am that bad boy. This chapter on enthusiasm begins in the private study of Andrew Carnegie during our 1908 meeting, where he is coaching his new protege in the art of controlled enthusiasm. "I am ready, Mr. Carnegie, for your analysis of the principle of individual achievement, which I believe you call enthusiasm. I wish you to define the meaning of this term and describe how one may develop enthusiasm at will."
"Enthusiasm can be developed by stimulating the faculty of the emotions."
"Then enthusiasm is emotion in action?"
"That is the brief way of stating it. Perhaps it would be more correctly stated if one said that enthusiasm is voluntary emotion, a feeling that one initiates at will. But you have overlooked one very important factor in your question, the question of control of enthusiasm. It is just as important to know how to modify, control, or shut off entirely the action of the emotions as it is to know how to start them into action. Before we go into the discussion of emotional control, however, let us take inventory of the benefits available through enthusiasm. To begin with, let us be reminded that enthusiasm is the result of desire expressed in terms of action and based upon motive. No normal person ever goes into a heat of enthusiasm without a motive. It is obvious, therefore, that the beginning of all enthusiasm is desire based on motive. There are two types of enthusiasm, passive and active. Perhaps it would be more accurate if I said that enthusiasm may be expressed in two ways, passively, through the stimulation of emotional feeling, and actively, by the expression of feeling through words or deeds.
Which is the more beneficial of the two, the active expression or the passive?
The answer to that depends upon the circumstances. Of course, passive enthusiasm always precedes the expression of active enthusiasm, as one must feel it before he can express it in any form of action or words. There are times when the expression of enthusiasm may be detrimental to one's interest, as it may indicate over-eagerness or disclose one's state of mind under circumstances when he does not wish to have it known to others. It is highly important, then, that one learn how to withhold the expression of his feelings under all circumstances. It is also important that one acquire the ability to give open expression of his feelings at will. In both instances, the control is the important factor. Now, let us briefly describe some of the benefits of both passive and active enthusiasm. First of all, let us remember that enthusiasm, which may be an expression of one or more of the emotions, stimulates the vibration of thought and makes it more intense, thus starting the faculty of the imagination to work in connection with the motive which inspired the enthusiasm. Enthusiasm gives tone quality to one's voice and makes it pleasing and impressive. A salesman or public speaker would be ineffective without the ability to turn on his enthusiasm at will. The same is true of one who engages in ordinary conversation. Even the most prosaic subjects can be made interesting if they are expressed with enthusiasm. Without it, the most interesting subjects can be boresome. Enthusiasm inspires initiative, both in thought and in physical action. It is very difficult for one to do well that in which he has no feeling of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm dispels physical fatigue and overcomes laziness. It has been said that there are no lazy men. What appears to be a lazy man is one who is moved by no motive over which he becomes enthusiastic. Enthusiasm stimulates the entire nervous system and causes it to perform its duties more efficiently, including, in particular, the function of digestion of food. For this reason, the meal hour should be the pleasantest hour of the day, and it should never become the occasion for settling personal or family differences of opinion, nor should it become the time for the correction of the faults of children. Enthusiasm stimulates the subconscious section of the brain and puts it to work in connection with the motive which inspires enthusiasm. In fact, there is no known method of stimulating the subconscious mind voluntarily except that of inspired feeling. Here let us emphasize the fact that the subconscious mind acts upon all feeling, whether it is negative or positive. It will act on the emotion of fear as quickly as it will act on the emotion of love. Or it will go to work on the worry over poverty as quickly as it will act on the feeling of opulence. It is important, therefore, to recognize that enthusiasm is the positive expression of feeling. Enthusiasm is contagious. It affects everyone within its range, a fact that is well known to all master salesmen. Moreover, one may influence others through either the active or the passive expression of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm discourages all forms of negative thought and dispels fear and worry, thus preparing the mind for the expression of faith. Enthusiasm is the twin brother of the faculty of the will, it being the major source of sustained action of the will. It is also a sustaining force in connection with persistence. We might say, therefore, that willpower, persistence, and enthusiasm are triplets which give one sustained action with a minimum loss of physical energy. As a matter of fact, enthusiasm converts fatigue and static energy into active energy. Emerson spoke a deeper truth than most people recognize when he said that nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. He must have known that enthusiasm gives quality to every word a man speaks, to every task at which he sets his hands.
I have heard it said that writers unconsciously project their enthusiasm or the lack of it in every word they write, so that even the casual reader may interpret the writer's mental attitude as he wrote. Is this a sound theory?
Not just a sound theory, but a fact. Try it out on yourself and be convinced. A man's writing may be translated into other languages, but it will very largely carry with it the same tempo of enthusiasm the writer felt when writing. I have heard it said that the writer of advertisements who feels no enthusiasm in connection with his copy writes poor copy no matter how many facts he may describe. I have also heard it said that the lawyer who feels no enthusiasm over his case fails to be convincing to judges and juries. And there is plenty of evidence that the enthusiasm of a doctor is his greatest remedy in the sick room. Enthusiasm is one of the greatest builders of confidence, for everyone knows that enthusiasm and faith are closely related. Enthusiasm connotes hope and courage and belief in oneself. I do not recall ever having promoted a man to a higher position or ever having employed a man for a responsible position who did not first demonstrate his enthusiasm over the possibilities of the position. I have observed that the young people who have gone to work in our offices as clerks and stenographers have promoted themselves into more responsible positions in almost exact ratio to the enthusiasm they displayed in their work.
Is it not possible for one to display too much enthusiasm for his own good?
Yes. Uncontrolled enthusiasm often is as detrimental as no enthusiasm. For example, the man who is so enthusiastic over himself and his own ideas that he monopolizes the conversation when conversing with others is sure to be unpopular, not to mention the fact that he misses many opportunities to learn by listening to others. Then there is the man who becomes too enthusiastic over the roulette wheel or the horses, and the man who becomes more enthusiastic over ways and means of getting something for nothing than he does over rendering useful service, not to mention the woman who becomes more enthusiastic over card parties and society than she does over making her home and herself attractive to her husband. This sort of uncontrolled enthusiasm may be very detrimental to all whom it affects.
Is enthusiasm of any value to the man engaged in manual labor?
Well, I can best answer that by calling your attention to the fact that most of the higher officials of my own organization began in the humblest of positions. The man who made the greatest progress of all my associates began as a stake driver, and he formerly worked as a teamster. His boundless enthusiasm was the quality that first attracted my attention to him, and it was the same quality that lifted him step by step into the highest position we had to offer. Yes, enthusiasm can be of value to anyone, regardless of his occupation, for it is a quality that attracts friends, establishes confidence, and breaks down the opposition of others.
What part, if any, does enthusiasm or lack of it play in the relationship of the home?
Well, let us go back a little way and consider the part that enthusiasm plays in bringing men and women together in a bond of marriage. Did you ever hear of a man winning the woman of his choice without displaying considerable enthusiasm over her? And it also works the other way round. A man will not be inclined to propose marriage to the woman who shows no enthusiasm over him. Mutual enthusiasm, therefore, is usually the basis of marriage, and woe unto the party to the marriage who allows that enthusiasm to wane afterward. We speak of the relationship as love. But what is love but mutual enthusiasm of two people over each other?
Under what circumstances does enthusiasm reach its highest degree of personal benefit?
In a mastermind alliance, two or more people work together in a spirit of perfect harmony for the attainment of a definite purpose. Here the enthusiasm of each member of the alliance projects itself into the mind of all the other members, and the sum total of enthusiasm thus created, by the harmonious blending of a group of minds, becomes available to and influences each individual.
I can see that enthusiasm is a greatly misunderstood word, judging by what you've been telling me.
Yes, it is perhaps the most misunderstood word in the English language. Most so-called enthusiasm is nothing but an uncontrolled expression of one's ego, a state of mental excitement which is easily recognized as nothing but a meaningless expression of personal vanity. That sort of enthusiasm may be very detrimental to those who indulge in it, as they usually express themselves in some form of exaggeration.
Will you give more details concerning your statement that many of your employees have promoted themselves through the expression of enthusiasm? Just what effect did their enthusiasm have on their jobs that entitled them to promotion?
It not only had an effect on their own jobs, but it affected those who worked with them. A man with a negative mind working in a plant where he may contact hundreds of other workmen may influence all the others to become also negative to a greater or lesser degree. The same principle applies where one has a positive mind and expresses enthusiasm in connection with his work. Any state of mind is contagious. Now you can see why an employee with a positive mind is worth more than one with a negative mind. The employee who thinks in terms of enthusiasm naturally is one who is happy in his work. He therefore radiates a wholesome mental attitude that spreads to those around him, and they too take on a part of his attitude. Accordingly, they become more efficient workers. But that is not the only reason why the person who expresses enthusiasm as a habit promotes himself into the more desirable positions of life. Enthusiasm, as I have already stated, gives one a keener imagination, increases his initiative, makes him more alert of mind, gives him a more pleasing personality, and thereby attracts the cooperation of others. These traits of mind make it inevitable that one will promote himself into any position which he may become capable of filling. Every thought one releases becomes a definite part of one's character. This transformation takes place through the principle of auto-suggestion. One does not have to be a mathematician to figure out what will happen to the person whose dominating thoughts are positive, in view of the fact that such a person is adding power to his own character with every thought he releases. Thought by thought, he builds a personality that provides him with a strong will, a keen imagination, self-reliance, persistence, initiative, and the courage and ambition to desire and to acquire whatever he wants. An employer has but little to do with the promotion of such a person. If one employer neglects to recognize his ability, he finds another who will, but he manages to keep growing and advancing in any direction he chooses.
I get the idea, Mr. Carnegie. An employee whose mind is dominated by the spirit of enthusiasm is beneficial to an employer, not only by his influence on other employees, but because of his own acquired strength of personality. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly what I mean. And the principle applies to everyone, not merely to an employee. Take the owner of a retail store, for example, and you will find that his mental attitude is definitely reflected in every person who works in the store. I have heard it said that a skilled psychologist can walk through any retail store, study the employees a few minutes, and then give a surprisingly accurate description of the owner or the dominating head of the store, without ever seeing him or hearing a word spoken by him.
Then one might say that a store or a business has its own personality, consisting of the dominating influence of the personnel of the business. Is that true?
Yes, it is true of the home or any place where people gather regularly. The psychologist with a keen sense of perception can walk into any home, get the mental feel of the place, and tell precisely whether the home is dominated by the spirit of harmony or the spirit of bickering and friction. The mental attitude of people leaves its permanent influence on the very atmosphere of their environment. Every city, for example, has its own rate of vibration, made up of the dominating influences and the mental attitudes of the people who live there. Moreover, every street and every block in every street has its own personality, each being so different from the others that the trained psychologist can walk down any street blindfolded and pick up enough information from the mental feel of the street to give an accurate description of the people who live there.
That seems almost incredible, Mr. Carnegie.
Perhaps it may be, to the inexperienced person, but not so to the skilled interpreter of people's mental attitude. If you wish convincing evidence of the accuracy of what I have said, make an experiment of your own. Take a walk down Fifth Avenue in New York City, and observe the feeling of opulence you pick up as you go along. Then go across to the tenement section, take a stroll down that thoroughfare, and observe the feeling of defeatism and poverty that you will pick up. The experiment will provide you with undeniable evidence that the vibrations of Fifth Avenue and the vibrations of the Tenement Street are direct opposites, one negative, the other positive. Carry the experiment still further by going into private homes. Choose a home where you know there is domestic harmony and cooperation. Study carefully the mental feel you pick up in this home without anyone speaking a word to you. Then go into a home where you know the domestic relationship is disturbed by inharmony and family friction. Study the mental feel you pick up there. By the time you have made a dozen such experiments, you will know from first-hand experience that every home has a mental atmosphere that harmonizes perfectly with the mental attitude of those who live there. This experiment will also convince you that there is some unknown law of nature which fixes the habits of thought and tends to give them permanency. The law not only gives permanency to thought in the mind of the individual, but it extends the influence of that thought to the environment in which one lives.
I had already noticed the difference in the mental feel of different homes, but I had attributed this to the financial status of the occupants. It seemed to me that poverty-stricken homes reflected a feeling of poverty on account of the physical appearance of the home, the furnishings and the like, and that the homes where there was evidence of opulence reflected a feeling of opulence because of the physical evidence of opulence. Don't you think that physical appearances have something to do with the impressions one picks up in a home?
Physical appearances are deceiving if one relies upon them entirely. Many people are deceived in this manner. Evidences of opulence are no indication whatsoever of mental harmony. Neither is physical evidence of poverty any definite indication of lack of mental harmony. Do not assume, however, that physical surroundings are not important. They are important because they suggest a positive or negative mental attitude which the mind accepts and acts upon. The man who accepts an environment of poverty as reflected by its physical surroundings will find himself becoming poverty-conscious. On the other hand, the man who demands an environment of opulence will become success-conscious. The clothes one wears have a definite effect on one's mental attitude. And it has been proved that even so slight a detail as shoes with run-down heels will tend to give one a feeling of inferiority, and a soiled shirt or an unshaven face will do the same. These are facts with which everyone is familiar, although not everyone recognizes the far-reaching influence of such seemingly unimportant details. You can drive through the country and analyze the mental habits of the farmers by observing the appearance of their land and buildings. Those who have become poverty-conscious allow their farms and their buildings to become run down and seedy in appearance. Evidence of this is unmistakable. The same rule applies to the city home. Take one glance at it, and you can get an accurate impression of the mental attitude of those who occupy it. The evidence is reflected in the appearance of the lawn, the condition of the house, and the feel one gets when near the house.
Mr. Carnegie, you have opened to me a field of thought which I fear I have never explored before. You have given me a new standard by which to analyze people, by observation of their physical surroundings and their personal appearance.
The officials of the United States Army are very particular about the personal appearance of the soldiers under their command. They know from experience that slovenly men who neglect their personal appearance in their living quarters make poor fighters. That is why the Army and the Navy have regular inspection periods when everyone is looked over carefully. Personal appearances give an accurate insight into what takes place in the minds of men. The same rule applies less strictly in the field of business. Some retail stores, for example, are so particular about the personal appearance of their salespeople that they, too, have regular inspection periods. They have learned from experience that the public judges a store very largely by the appearance of its salespeople. Many an employee has attracted attention to himself and gained promotion by his neat personal appearance. Of course, the promotion was not based on the appearance alone, but it was a determining factor that connoted other qualities which go along with personal appearance.
Yes, I see. Personal appearances advertise one's mental attitude.
Now you have the idea. Try as one may, he cannot separate his mental attitude from his personal appearance and his physical environment. The two are closely akin. I wish to call your attention to the fact that this rule applies to domestic animals and to the birds and beasts of wildlife, the same as to man. The finer specimens take great care with their physical appearance. The songbirds keep their feathers clean and neatly arranged, while the more slovenly birds, such as the buzzard, pay less attention to their physical appearance. That old saying that cleanliness is next to godliness is by no means a mere figure of speech. The more spirited creatures of the earth reflect the nature of their spirit by their physical appearance and their environment. This alone should provide man with a clue by which to govern himself.
When you speak of the more spirited creatures, you have reference to those which show definite signs of enthusiasm, do you not?
Well, that would be one way of stating the matter. We might even speak of people as being either spirited or enthusiastic or lacking in this quality. The habits of slovenly, unspirited people are not unlike those of the unspirited creatures of the lower planes in the animal world. Yes, I think you might say that some animals reflect the spirit of enthusiasm. Take a well-bred dog, for example, and you will see an animal that can do almost everything but talk. And a dog can talk, too, in his own way.
Let us now consider some of the influences which discourage enthusiasm.
Very well. Let us begin by naming the more common antitheses of enthusiasm, heading the list with one of the most deadly of them all, viz. 1. Poverty. It has been said that when poverty comes in at the front door, hope, ambition, courage, initiative, and enthusiasm take to their heels and go out at the back door. 2. Illness. It is difficult for one to display enthusiasm over anything when he is physically or mentally ill. 3. Failure in business. Those who have not learned the art of converting defeat into renewed effort usually allow failure in business to drown out their spirit of enthusiasm. 4. Disappointment in love. I have never yet seen the person who could display convincing signs of genuine enthusiasm while suffering from this sort of disappointment. 5. Family disputes. It is difficult for a man to display enthusiasm in connection with his business, profession, or occupation if he knows that an argument awaits him when he arrives at home at the end of the day. 6. Religious indecision. When a man is upset because of indecision in connection with his religious beliefs, he finds his spirit of enthusiasm dampened. 7. Fear. Enthusiasm and fear make poor bedfellows, and this has reference to all types of fear. 8. Lack of a definite major purpose. The man who drifts with the stray winds of chance finds it difficult to control his enthusiasm. He usually displays enthusiasm, if at all, in connection with trivial matters that do him no permanent good. A fixed major purpose is the greatest of all the stimulants of enthusiasm. Give a man a goal around which he can build an obsessional desire for its attainment, and enthusiasm becomes a natural habit for him. 9. Lack of self-discipline. The man who allows his emotions to take possession of him is apt to become the victim of negative emotions, and these, of course, are fatal to enthusiasm. 10. Lack of faith in infinite intelligence. Perhaps the most beneficial type of enthusiasm is that which is displayed by the man who has learned how to place himself in tune with the infinite. But this type of man blends faith with enthusiasm in such a manner that he moves with definiteness in all he does. 11. The habit of procrastination. If and when the procrastinator displays enthusiasm, it is lacking in force because there is nothing definite back of it. 12. Acting on one's individual initiative without the cooperation of others. The mastermind principle gives one the most effective means of developing and applying enthusiasm. The man who lives as a lone wolf usually is a cynic with little sign of enthusiasm. 13. Disloyalty of friends and business associates. This type of perfidy usually dampens one's enthusiasm, temporarily at least. 14. Lack of education. While this is greatly overestimated as a dampener of enthusiasm, it remains, however, as such in the minds of many people. 15. Lack of opportunity for self-advancement. This rates along with poverty as an enthusiasm dampener. Most people seem never to have learned how to attract opportunity through the spirit of enthusiasm. 16. Unfriendly criticism. The majority of people go into their shells of silence and place their enthusiasm on cold storage the moment they are criticized, or they become cynical and strike back at their critics. 17. Old age. Some people accept the maturity of years not as an approach to greater wisdom, but as a sign of decline in ability. To the one who masters and applies this philosophy of individual achievement, maturity of years should bring increased ability, based on a better understanding and use of the mind. 18. Negative mental attitude. The habit of looking on the dark side of the circumstances of one's life is fatal to enthusiasm. 19. Doubt and worry. To be a habitual enthusiast, one must be a strong believer in something. Unbelievers are negative, and unbelief becomes a habit. If one indulges it in one direction, it assumes control in many directions. Worry is the child of doubt. It grows out of indecision and inaction. This is one of the commonest antitheses of enthusiasm, and is inexcusable because it is a habit that can be eliminated by the simple process of adopting a definite major purpose, and working that purpose so vigorously that there is no room in the mind for doubt. 20. The habit of associating with negative-minded people. No one can maintain a spirit of enthusiasm while fraternizing with pessimists and cynics. 21. Lack of ambition. 22. Skepticism and doubt. 23. Negative mental attitude expressed in criticism of others and of life in general. These are the major destroyers of enthusiasm. When the mind is dominated by any combination of these enthusiasm dampeners, it becomes negative. Enthusiasm is the product of a positive mind. I mean the sort of mind that is positive all the time as a matter of controlled habit. No one is doing the best of which he is capable until his work arouses all of the enthusiasm and zest of his being.
Then it is necessary that the mind be cleared of these negative habits before enthusiasm can become a part of one's thought habits?
Yes. Enthusiasm is an expression of hope, belief, and the will to win. It cannot thrive on doubt, unbelief, and indefiniteness of purpose. Enthusiasm must be developed through action appropriate to its nature. Wishing and daydreaming will not develop enthusiasm. When a man gets an obsessional desire to attain a definite goal and pitches in with everything he has to attain it, the action feature of his desire evolves into enthusiasm.
And enthusiasm prepares the mind for the expression of faith?
Developing enthusiasm involves three definite steps. First, one clears the mind thought habits. Second, one fills the mind with a definite major purpose based on a motive. Third, one begins action in carrying out the purpose and follows through so vigorously that the motive behind the purpose becomes an obsession. Negative thought habits can be eliminated by adopting other and stronger habits of the opposite nature. Here, too, physical action plays an important part. One cannot eliminate undesirable habits by merely wishing to eliminate them. They must be supplanted by stronger habits of a desirable nature.
There is no way, then, for one to escape work?
A majority of the people devote much of their time avoiding work, But so far, no one has been smart enough to accomplish this end without experiencing its natural consequences, failure.
If I understand you correctly, it is your belief that work can be made a pleasure if it is directed to a definite objective on which one has sold himself?
Now you have laid your finger on the key to all successful achievement. No man can succeed in the broader sense of the term without finding peace of mind and happiness. If a man cannot find happiness in connection with the pursuit of his definite major purpose, how would he find it? Many people make the mistake of believing that work serves only the purpose of acquiring material things, money, for example, the necessities and luxuries of life. But the truth is that work is the only means of finding happiness. An idle person never is happy. Happiness comes from doing that which one likes best to do. I have a great deal of money, but I tell you frankly that I get no happiness from it. Such happiness as I have experienced came from planning, building, and creating, and helping other men to find their places in the world. Money and material things do not provide fellowship except by their use in providing action for the owner. The miser never is happy. But the man who uses his material wealth to give expression to his own mind and to aid others in expressing themselves may become happy. Yes, work can become a pleasure if one engages in it in the right attitude. I once asked Thomas A. Edison how he managed to work such long hours without wearing himself out. It was no surprise to me when he said, "I am so keenly interested in what I am doing that what you call work is recreation to me. My trouble is not long hours. It is the shortness of the hours. I begrudge the time I have to give over to sleep." And he told the truth. His work has become his obsession. His interest in it is so keen that he finds happiness in it. That is the experience of every man who has found his work and is engaged in doing it in a spirit of enthusiasm. Edison's enthusiasm takes the drudgery out of his work. That's how he manages to keep at a task through thousands of failures until he finishes it. And that's why he is the world's greatest inventor. Inventing is his hobby. He does not work at it. He plays with it, and plays hard. Observe any man who has made work an obsession, and you will discover that he gets happiness from it.
Yes, I get your viewpoint, but my mind keeps reverting to people who are born in an environment of poverty and illiteracy. I know something of that sort of environment because I was born in it. How is one going to become enthusiastic over anything when everything he sees, everyone he associates with, suggests poverty?
I think you can answer your own question by recalling how you escaped the undesirable environment of your birth. What steps did you take? What state of mind did you develop that permitted you to choose a more desirable environment? You have plenty of enthusiasm. Very well. How did you come by it? When you have answered these questions, you will have answered your own question much better than I could answer it.
I escaped the undesirable environment of my birth because of the influence of a remarkable woman who refused to accept poverty, my stepmother. She fired my imagination with a desire to adopt a definite major purpose, and I followed it out of the jungle. Her enthusiasm was, as you have stated, contagious. I caught it, and it became my own. But I was fortunate in having come by chance under the influence of a positive mind. Not everyone is so fortunate. What of those who are not so favored by chance? How are they to escape the deadening effects of a poverty-stricken environment?
I am glad you have asked those questions because I have the answer, and I wish you to remember it. I have already told you that the turning point in every man's life, at which he begins to supplant the poverty consciousness and the spirit of defeatism with the will to win, is reached generally when he comes under the influence of some person with a positive mind. I will admit that in most cases this turning point is reached by a chance meeting with the right type of person. In fact, I wish to emphasize this fact. It was the recognition of this very fact which inspired me to search over a long period of years for a man to help me organize the philosophy of individual achievement. This philosophy, when it is completed, will serve as that necessary outside influence which a man needs to enable him to break away from anything he does not want, including a poverty consciousness. You see, therefore, that you are being schooled to help me answer the very important question which you have asked. When the philosophy has been completely organized and tested, it will be taken to the people in the humblest environments of the nation and world. And let us not forget, as we organize the philosophy, to prepare it in terms that the humblest person can understand. In our presentation of the philosophy, we must not only tell the people what they should do to escape the circumstances of life they do not wish, but we must teach them how to do it. The philosophy must be as nearly foolproof as human ingenuity can make it.
So, my questions have kicked back on me like a boomerang.
No, your questions have opened to me the opportunity I've been waiting for, an opportunity to impress you with the nature of the responsibility you have undertaken. I want you to follow through with your job with the feeling that you are to become a liberator of poverty-bound people. You are preparing yourself to help people unlock the prison doors of their own minds, where they have confined themselves by their self-imposed limitations. Look upon your job in this light, and you'll never have any need to worry about your own enthusiasm, unless it is to save you from driving yourself too hard and fast. Now, may I tell you something that should give you great satisfaction? You were chosen as my emissary to help prepare the philosophy of individual achievement for the people of America and the world, not alone because of your alertness in recognizing and acting upon the opportunity when I offered it to you, but for the further reason that the background of your humble birth has prepared you to recognize the need for an inspirational philosophy designed to awaken people and help them throw off their poverty consciousness. You know what poverty is because you have lived in it. You know what opulence is because you are now beginning to enjoy it. Most important of all, you know the way out of poverty, or you will know the way out by the time you finish your job in organizing the philosophy of individual achievement. Thus you have found in your own experience one of the greatest evidences of the soundness of the theory that adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. Your greatest opportunity grew out of the handicap under which you were born. I wish you to be impressed by this. I wish you to impress others with this same thought, for it is one of the most important facts of life. Its importance becomes obvious to its fullest degree in time of emergency, when one is overtaken by defeat and one's enthusiasm has been wiped out. The person who has mastered this philosophy will not only discover that defeat is only temporary, but he will know, at the time of defeat, that somewhere in connection with it there is the seed of an equivalent victory, and he will begin to search for that seed. Thus discouragement can be converted into enthusiasm.
So I can see by the twinkle in your eyes that you deliberately led me into asking a question that gave you an opening to teach me a lesson?
I must confess that you are right. Yes, I have been waiting for just this moment to catch you off guard so I could help you convert doubt into faith. I have known for some time that you were worrying about how people who were born in a negative environment may escape. Your worry was the child of your own experience, and you are not yet far enough removed from the environment in which you were born to enable you to throw off its effects. Let that give you no further concern. From now on, you will be associated with men who are success conscious, and their influence will give you hope and faith, for you will discover then every one of them went through some sort of experience similar to your own before they took possession of their own minds. Yes, I did set a trap for you, and I'm glad you fell into it, for it gave me an opportunity to force you to become your own teacher on a subject of the greatest importance in connection with the job that lies ahead of you. In the future, when you tell anyone that, Adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. You may speak from your own experience. What you say will be more convincing to others because it will be based on what you know, not what you have heard. I have still other traps prepared for you, so be on the lookout.
Am I to understand from what you have said that people who are born in a poverty-stricken environment can escape only through the influence of someone with a positive mind?
Oh, no. Some people are born with an inherent nature which drives them to find their own means of escape from poverty, and they begin searching for the way out as soon as they are thrown on their own responsibility.
But they find the way out much sooner if they have the aid of people who inspire them with ambition and confidence. Is that the idea?
Yes, that is true. But it has been my experience that even those who begin to search for a way to master poverty and find it usually contact someone sooner or later who inspires them with imagination, initiative, or some other quality that is instrumental in helping them. I do not recall having ever known of anyone succeeding in a noteworthy degree without the influence of one or more people who aided them. Whatever success I have attained has been due largely to the aid I received from others.
Do you advocate the habit of one's relying on others for aid, or should one move on his own initiative?
The man who moves on his own initiative has a much better chance of succeeding than the one who depends on others. When a man wishes to do something, he should begin on his own initiative and work with whatever tools he may have at hand. He will come into possession of greater resources in proportion to his use of his own available resources. The world does not favor the person who depends too greatly upon others for his own promotion. I once saw a motto which impressed me very much. It said, "Some people succeed when encouraged by others, while a few succeed in spite of the devil and all his angels." I rather like the latter part of the motto. Encouragement from others is a great benefit. Encouragement from oneself is an indispensable necessity.
What encouragement have you for the man who is born with a will to win but lacks the inherent quality of enthusiasm? You know, of course, there are such people. Are they doomed to failure?
Now you have come dangerously near to setting your foot into another trap by your question. I have answered this question for you previously. I want you to answer that question for yourself.
Yes, of course. You mean that the mastermind principle provides one with the medium by which any individual deficiency may be bridged. Isn't that what you have in mind, Mr. Carnegie?
Precisely. I can name for you a dozen men who show no signs of active enthusiasm, yet they are succeeding in their chosen calling. They have been wise enough to include in their mastermind group one or more who have the necessary capacity for enthusiasm. I have several men in my mastermind group who are entirely lacking in the quality of enthusiasm, so much so, in fact, that one of them is known as the wet blanket man of the group. We have him in the group for that purpose. It is his business to find out the plans which will not work. He questions everything and everyone. If he ever smiles, it is while he is asleep. But he is one of our most valuable men. He would be less valuable, however, if we did not have others in the group who, by their enthusiasm, put their imaginations to work and create plans and ideas. It is very seldom that the creator of an idea can be the best critic of its merits.
It seems to me that I may have led you into a trap, Mr. Carnegie, for you have just admitted that a man may become an important part of an organization without enthusiasm.
Think again, for you have overlooked the fact that I said we have men in our mastermind group who supply enthusiasm. Well, the man without enthusiasm profits by his association with those who have it, just as they profit by their association with him. He needs their ideas, and they need his balancing influence.
I see what you mean. The man without enthusiasm probably would not be so valuable if he moved solely on his own initiative.
That's the idea that springs your trap for me. And now may I call your attention to the fact that you've just walked into the trap you thought you were setting for me. You now have a viewpoint in connection with the mastermind principle which I have been trying to impress upon you. You know that a mastermind group should consist of creators of ideas and critics of ideas, both types working in harmony. Every mastermind group should have at least one wet blanket man to test the ideas of the others. Only in this way can you have balanced enthusiasm. One of the weaknesses of most individuals who are inspired by enthusiasm is their lack of a dependable means of controlling their enthusiasm through the influence of a constructive critic.
I get your idea, Mr. Carnegie, and I shall not forget to include it in the philosophy of individual achievement. I fear it is the lack of understanding of the point you have explained, which accounts for the poor judgment so many men use in choosing their business associates.
Now you are doing some real analyzing. I have seen it proved over and over again that failure in business is generally due to the wrong association of men. Modern industry is so complex it requires many types of men to manage it successfully. The business that is loaded too heavily with one type of man has two strikes against it to begin with.
How do you manage to keep your wet blanket man from killing off the enthusiasm of your idea men?
In a well-managed business, it is understood that both types of men have a place, that both are necessary for the successful operation of the business. You understand, of course, that professional criticism is a far different thing from voluntary, uninvited criticism, such as some men offer to others in social relationships. Professional criticism is, or should be, accepted as friendly analysis intended to benefit all whom it influences. Personal criticism usually is nothing but an expression of disapproval, often based on antagonism.
You believe, then, that an employer should be subject to friendly criticism from his employees?
If he is not getting the best service from those who work with him. Employers who surround themselves with yes-men, as many do, seldom succeed, and they never attain the success they might enjoy if they invited friendly criticism.
Your analysis is very revealing, Mr. Carnegie. I'm beginning to see what you meant when you said that your greatest contribution to the steel industry, of which you are the recognized head, consists in your ability to pick men who can and will do what is required of them. If I have judged your remarks correctly, you are now coaching me in the art of building an organization of efficient men. Is that your idea?
That is exactly what I'm doing. The philosophy of individual achievement will fail in its mission unless it clearly explains the proper approach to all human relationships. Human relationship is the most important subject in the world. Success and failure both hinge upon it. The greatest service that any educational system can render anyone is that of teaching him how to negotiate his way through life with a minimum of opposition from others. This is far more important than training in the arts and sciences. Men who are skilled in the arts and sciences are plentiful. They can be employed for wages. Men who are skilled in forming harmonious human relationships are scarce. Remember that the major burden of the philosophy of individual achievement is that of training men to relate themselves to others in a spirit of harmony and in the ability to influence others to do the same.
I understand what you mean, Mr. Carnegie. I also understand much more about the subject of enthusiasm than I did when we began this discussion. The subject cannot be satisfactorily treated as a single unit. It is related to other principles of this philosophy, which must be applied with it in order to make it effective as a means of promoting one's individual interests.
Now you are gaining an understanding of the philosophy with a true perspective. Every principle of the philosophy is related to every other principle. The principles are interlocking, like the links of a chain. Enthusiasm, for example, is directly related to the principles of self-discipline, attractive personality, organized endeavor, and organized thought. Remove self-discipline from enthusiasm, and you are dealing with a force that may serve only to lead one into dangerous habits of exaggeration.
That word habit creeps into this philosophy quite often, too.
Yes, and so does the word action. Both are key words. Habits are developed through the repetition of action, and this applies